You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is The Game. The program has been announced. The implementation has begun. The chair does not need to win a majority for a standalone cut on the merits of incoming inflation data because he has changed what the committee will be voting on. On April 21, 2026, Kevin Warsh sat for confirmation before the Senate Banking Committee and bound the next Federal Reserve chairmanship to a specific operational program. On May 22, he was sworn in by the President and elected chair of the Federal Open Market Committee on the same day. The coordination documented the architecture: four instruments held across two seats, a fifth instrument held by an outside seat the testimony did not name, a unified doctrinal program presented as separate, independent decisions. The analog documented the framework the committee has begun applying to the present energy shock, the look-through doctrine that worked when oil mean reverted, that failed when it did not, and that the institution cannot tell in real time which case it is operating on. The program is announced. The personnel are placed. The opening moves have been played in public, on calendar, in venues where the speeches and testimonies enter the institutional record as positioning rather than as policy. The investigation that follows is not into whether the program exists. It exists. The investigation is into what the chair is actually doing now that the program is in motion, what the standard reading of his position misses, and what the Federal Reserve's documentary record shows about every prior occasion an incoming chair has constructed a framework of the form Warsh is constructing. The game has started. These are the opening moves and the archive's record of what happens when a chair plays this opening. The game that has started. The standard reading of Warsh's position is a coalition-building problem. The chair arrives at a committee divided four ways. Stephen Miron on the board votes to cut at every meeting. Three other governors dissented in April against statement language that suggested eventual easing. The hawkish regional presidents, Schmid at Kansas City, Musalem at St. Louis, anchor the analytical opposition to accommodation. The institutional center sits between them, the chairman emeritus remaining on the board, the vice chair, the New York Fed president, the vice chair for supervision. Under the standard reading, Warsh's program requires him to assemble a majority for a cut against a committee that has already shown its dissent flaw, and to assemble it on the merits of incoming inflation data, where the analytical case is contested. This reading misses the structural move. A rate cut still requires an FOMC majority. The chair's actual work is upstream of the vote. Across speeches, testimonies, and operational sequencing in the months since his nomination, Warsh and the seats coordinated with him have been constructing an analytical framework under which the next vote is no longer a vote on accommodation in isolation. It is positioned to become a vote on whether to ratify a recalibration the framework has already established. The committee can vote yes on ratification of a constructed framework where it would vote no on a standalone cut argued on the merits of inflation data alone. Same procedural action, different analytical category. The chair does not need to win a coalition on the merits of the cut. He needs to change the category under which the coalition is asked to act. The opening moves are a matter of public record. On January 16, 2026, while Warsh was being vetted, Michelle Bowman delivered a speech at the New England Economic Forum positioning the labor market as fragile and the Federal Reserve's monetary stance as approaching neutral. On March 3, 2026, Bowman returned to the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation Roundtable and connected liquidity regulation, bank reserve demand, and Federal Reserve balance sheet size in a single causal chain. From the Michelle Bowman, banks create additional buffers by hoarding high-quality liquid assets rather than lending. This liquidity hoarding reduces credit availability to the economy. In addition, by increasing the demand for reserves, it also requires the Fed to maintain a larger balance sheet to meet that demand. On April 21, 2026, the day of Warsh's hearing, Trump told reporters he would be disappointed if Warsh did not cut rates quickly. The political authorization arrived publicly. On April 22nd, Scott Bessent testified before Senate Appropriations and merged Federal Reserve and Treasury Swap Line Authority into a single operational category. From the Scott Bessent, swap lines, whether it's from the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, are to maintain order in the dollar funding markets and to prevent the sale of the US assets in a disorderly way. The jewel box distinction that normally separates Federal Reserve Emergency Authority from Treasury diplomacy was blurred on the record, in testimony, in front of senators. None of these statements is an FOMC vote. None of them changes the funds rate or the balance sheet. Together they construct an analytical category. Labor market fragility supplied by Bowman, regulatory linkage to balance sheet size supplied by Bowman, political authorization supplied by Trump, Treasury Federal Reserve operational fungibility supplied by Bessent, under which a future rate cut presents as recalibration of an integrated policy framework rather than as a standalone accommodation decision. The single contradiction this investigation tests is whether the framework Warsh is constructing changes the meaning of the upcoming vote, or whether the institution will see through it. The chair has bound himself, under oath, to an outcome that requires the committee to ratify a framework the chair has authored. Whether the committee ratifies is not a question about procedural votes. A procedural majority is still required. The question is whether the analytical category Warsh has placed on the board is one the institutional centre can stand behind without appearing politically captured. That question has been asked 5 times before in the institution's documented history. The chair built the framework. The committee ratified. The archive recorded what followed. The borrowed method. The framework Warsh is constructing belongs to a documented methodological family. The Federal Reserve has used this family across 5 decades to convert contested policy decisions into ratification votes by supplying the committee with analytical categories that make the chair's preferred outcome the natural reading of incoming data. The family has 2 variants. Both work by changing what the committee is being asked to decide. The successful variant was Paul Volcker's. The 1989 FOMC technical material laid out the apparatus that had been constructed in the 1979 to 82 period. 3 alternative hypotheses about inflation expectations, with the strong credibility case as the counterfactual the institution would have to validate through action rather than assume. Volcker did not ask the committee to approve higher rates on the merits of incoming inflation data. He constructed a framework under which the question on the table became whether to validate the credibility commitment the institution had publicly made. Bernanke's 2004 retrospective named the mechanism. From the Ben Bernanke. The significance of Paul Volcker's appointment was not its immediate effect on expectations or credibility, but rather the fact that he was one of the rare individuals tough enough and with sufficient foresight to do what had to be done. The framework Volcker constructed made the rate decision a credibility validation decision. The committee ratified the framework's natural output. The variant succeeded because the rate decision the framework authorized was the rate decision the inflation data was demanding. The failed variant has been applied repeatedly, and the archive has scored every application. Arthur Burns, from 1973 through 1979, constructed a framework under which the rate decision was a decision about whether to validate or look through exogenous supply shocks. The analog documented this specific case at the doctrine level, comparing the 1973-74 OPEC shock to the modern look-through cases the framework handles correctly. The broader observation here is that look-through is 1 variant within a wider family. The committee ratified the look-through reading. Lawrence Roos at the St. Louis Fed named the institutional mechanism while it was operating.
From the Lawrence Roos. Sometimes I think we like to believe that we are prisoners of exogenous factors. What part of that 10% is a reflection of monetary policy? And what part is a reflection of energy and food prices? Ruse was making the anti-decomposition argument. Burns had constructed the analytical category under which the rate decision could be made without addressing the aggregate inflation reading. Ruse refused the category. The committee, however, was not required to accept his refusal because the category had already been supplied. The institutional default became to operate within it. The Volcker disinflation, when it came, was the consequence of the category Burns had built and the institution had ratified throughout the decade. The engine scored Ruse's prescience at 1.0. The pattern recurred. Alan Greenspan from 1996 through 2000 constructed the Boskin discount framework under which the rate decision was a decision about whether the headline inflation reading overstated true inflation. The committee ratified the discount, and the late 1990s expansion ran warmer than the unadjusted Phillips curve would have prescribed. From 2011 through 2019, Bernanke and Yellen constructed the special factors framework, under which the rate decision was a decision about whether persistent below-target inflation reflected transient measurement issues. The committee ratified the framework, and the framework's natural output was prolonged accommodation. In 2007, the public statement claimed no spillovers from subprime, contradicting staff analysis from 7 days earlier. The committee ratified the no spillovers framing, and the framework collapsed within a year. In 2020 and 2021, the framework was transitory, and the 2019 staff memo had predicted the outcome before the framework was adopted. From the board staff, with impaired transmission of policy through expectations, downside misses of the inflation target persist for longer, resulting in aggressively accommodative policy prescriptions under both the AIT and PLT rules. This, in turn, leads to a substantial overheating of the economy. The chair constructs framework, committee ratifies move, is the institution's standard mechanism for resolving contested policy decisions. The methodology is real. The methodology has been used to support outcomes the institution later defended and outcomes the institution later regretted. The variable that distinguishes the successful applications from the failed applications is whether the rate decision the framework authorizes is consistent with what realized data requires. Volcker's framework demanded action the data required. The Burns, Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, 2007, and 2021 frameworks demanded action the data did not support, and each application was identified in advance by institutional dissenters whose prescience the archive subsequently scored at the upper end of the range. Warsh is constructing a framework of the family that has been applied 5 times and failed 5 times. The labor market fragility framing supplied by Bowman, the balance sheet regulatory floor framing supplied by Bowman's March speech, the swap line fungibility framing supplied by Besant's April testimony, the political authorization framing supplied by Trump's "I would" on the day of the hearing. These are not coalition-building moves. They are framework construction moves. The next FOMC vote, when it arrives, is positioned to become a vote on whether to ratify the framework the chair has built, rather than a vote on accommodation argued on inflation data alone. The institution's documented record on this move is unambiguous about what has followed in prior applications. The four instruments and the floor. The operational program the testimony names runs through 2 seats. The chair holds 3 instruments. The Treasury Secretary holds the 4th. Each instrument is either publicly positioned, procedurally available, or assigned to a seat that can move without requiring the full framework to be voted on at once. The distinction matters. The framework's strength as a ratification device does not depend on coordinated execution. Positioning is sufficient to supply the institutional category. Execution follows after. The first instrument is passive runoff. The instrument is presently inactive. On October 29, 2025, the FOMC announced that it would conclude the reduction of the Federal Reserve's aggregate securities holdings beginning December 1, 2025. The program, Warsh's testimony commits to, therefore requires reactivating runoff, not continuing it, and likely at caps higher than those in force when the program was paused. Under the prior cap structure, passive Treasury maturity capacity ran at roughly $600 billion per year, with mortgage-backed prepayments adding another $200 billion. The ceiling reached roughly $1.6 trillion over 24 months, 80% of the stated target on the asset side. Reactivating runoff is the first operational decision available to the chair under the framework. The decision would be a vote, but it would be a vote on resuming an instrument the institution has used continuously for years, framed as a return to the prior cap regime or an acceleration of it. The framework category is continuation of normalization, not new tightening initiative. The committee is positioned to ratify the category. The second instrument is the administered rate decision. The chair votes to lower the interest rate on reserve balances and the overnight reverse repo rate. The short end of the curve moves by fiat. The political authorization arrived on the day of the hearing. Besant had stated the operational language 9 months before. From the Kevin Warsh, run the printing press a little bit less, let the balance sheet come down, let Secretary Besant handle the fiscal accounts, and in so doing, you can have materially lower interest rates. Balance sheet reduction, however, is a quantity operation that runs in the opposite direction. It removes Federal Reserve demand for duration from the primary market and forces private buyers to absorb more duration per year than they otherwise would. Standard term structure theory assigns this pressure to the term premium. Long rates, all else equal, rise. The natural operational outcome of simultaneous rate cut and quantitative tightening is a bull steepener. Short rates fall, long rates rise or fall less. The promise of materially lower interest rates attaches to the entire curve. The framework requires something else to pull the long end down, even as asset reduction pushes it up. The third instrument is active mortgage-backed security sales. The Federal Reserve's open market desk sells into primary dealers, who distribute to REITs, insurers, and foreign buyers. Federal Reserve Board staff research on the 2017 to 2019 balance sheet normalization estimated the supply elasticity at roughly 10 to 15 basis points of yield widening per 100 billion of MBS supply, sensitive to dealer balance sheet capacity and prepayment speeds. At 300 billion per year of active sales, the mortgage rate drag is on the order of 30 to 45 basis points. The active sales instrument closes part of the asset side supply gap and adds upward pressure to the mortgage market the rate cut promise was supposed to relieve. The fourth instrument sits in the second seat. The Treasury Secretary controls the composition of new debt issuance through the quarterly refunding statements. If Treasury shortens the weighted average maturity, more bills, fewer long bonds, the private market does not have to absorb long duration at the pace Federal Reserve runoff would otherwise require. Besant's publicly stated preference is shorter issuance. Warsh's testimony assigned the instrument operationally to that seat. The next quarterly refunding statement is the next observable test of this instrument under the framework, and any move on it would require no FOMC vote at all. The four instruments, deployed in coordination, reach roughly 80% of the stated target on the asset side of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. The binding constraint, however, is on the liability side. Every asset reduction lands primarily on falling reserves. The Federal Reserve has approached the binding floor once before. The September 2019 Teal Book prepared for the meeting at which the institution would shortly discover what it did not yet know, recorded the staff's assessment. From the board staff, the results do not suggest that reserves are currently close to the steep part of the reserve demand curve.
3 days later, the overnight repo rate spiked outside its target range. The federal funds rate followed. Emergency repo operations were authorized. The chair's operational summary in December named what the staff analysis had missed. From the Jerome Powell, a standing repo facility would make firms less eager to hold reserves as a liquidity buffer, enabling us to run a smaller balance sheet. The floor was not set by Federal Reserve asset holdings. It was set by banks' demand for reserves as a liquidity buffer. That demand is generated, structurally, by the liquidity coverage ratio. The floor is a regulatory artifact. It is not within the chair's open market authority to move. It is not within the Treasury Secretary's debt management authority to move. The four instruments the testimony authorizes do not reach the regulation that sets the floor. The architecture stops short of the seat that does, and the testimony does not name that seat. The framework cannot be ratified by the committee as full delivery of the program unless the seat that holds the binding instrument moves in coordination with the seat that authored the framework. The fifth instrument and the behavioral bet. The seat that holds the fifth instrument is the Vice Chair for Supervision, held by Bowman since June 2025. Her March 3, 2026 speech named the linkage between her supervisory portfolio and the monetary mechanics Warsh's program depends on. The labour market fragility framing she had placed in the institutional record the prior January is the analytical category the framework is positioned to recruit when the next rate decision is considered. The reserve demand floor framing from March is the analytical category that would make the balance sheet program ratifiable as complete delivery if the regulatory recalibration she has announced is operationally implemented before the program's reserve constraint binds. The compatibility claim closes the institutional argument. Recalibrate the liquidity coverage ratio. Allow banks to recognize, up to a cap, their capacity to borrow from the Federal Reserve when collateral is pre-positioned at the discount window as equivalent to held high-quality liquid assets. The reserve demand floor moves. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet can be smaller. The fifth instrument the four-instrument arithmetic requires is authorized by its own speaker, operationally specified in its own venue, on its own calendar. The two programs interlock at the single piece of plumbing both require. The institution has attempted modernization of the discount window and lender of last resort facilities in successive forms across the post-1980s period. Statutory restriction after FDICIA in 1991 tightened the conditions under which the window could be accessed. The 2003 primary credit redesign separated the rate structure from the federal funds target to reduce the implicit penalty signal. The term auction facility of 2007 through 2010 made term liquidity available anonymously through auction. Pandemic-era emergency easing in 2020 broadened eligible collateral and loosened terms. The 2021 standing repo facility, structurally distinct from the discount window, but designed for a parallel liquidity backstop need, provided pre-committed access for primary dealers. The Bank Term Funding Program of 2023 made fixed-rate term funding available against collateral at par after the Silicon Valley Bank failure. Each reform addressed a specific operational friction. Each was designed by the institution's most technically capable officials. Each had explicit chair-level backing. None of them produced sustained behavioural change of the kind Bowman's 2026 programme presumes. Banks treated each facility as an emergency tool, used it during the specific stress event for which it was designed, and returned to excluding the relevant capacity from realistic liquidity stacks once the stress passed. The standing repo facility has been used modestly without breaking the stigma equilibrium that constrains primary credit use. The institution's most relevant witness on whether the next attempt will deliver what these prior reforms did not is Bowman herself. On April 3, 2024, speaking at the same Committee on Capital Markets Regulation venue at which she would, 2 years later, announce the prescription, She stated the institutional position.
From the Michelle Bowman. The Federal Reserve cannot entirely eliminate discount window borrowing stigma through regulatory fiat. The 2024 analysis was the synthesis of more than three decades of institutional experience with the precise reform Bowman's seat would shortly attempt. The Federal Reserve's reform tools cannot eliminate the demand-side dynamic that generates the stigma. Bank treasurers' rational calculations about the reputational cost of detection do not adjust to administrative rule changes on the supply side. The pre-positioning approach Bowman has proposed for 2026 is methodologically more sophisticated than the prior attempts. It credits the capacity to borrow rather than incentivizing actual borrowing. It bypasses the stigma channel by treating the lodged collateral as the operational substitute for held reserves. The design is novel. The question is not whether the design is novel, but whether the novelty exceeds what successive reform cycles have shown the equilibrium will absorb. The framework Warsh is constructing does not require Bowman's reform to succeed in order for the next rate cut to be ratifiable. The labour market fragility framing alone is sufficient to supply the institutional category under which the rate decision presents as recalibration. What Bowman's reform determines is whether the balance sheet half of the program closes at 80% of target or stalls at roughly 40%. The rate cut is ratifiable on the framing Bowman had placed in the record before the framework existed. The full program is contingent on a behavioral change Bowman's own April 2024 voice predicted would not occur. The chair is making two bets, and only one of them needs to win in order for the rate cut to be delivered. The other determines whether the program is remembered as a successful framework or as a partial delivery announced as complete. The remedy that doesn't transmit. The strongest version of the program's case is not the operational arithmetic, it is the distributional theory. Speaking on CNBC in July 2025, in front of a sympathetic anchor, Warsh framed the public meaning of the recalibration the rest of the program is constructed to deliver. From the Kevin Warsh, take a little of this looseness out of financial markets by getting the Fed out of the fiscal business, out of the political business, shrink that, and then redeploy some of that liquidity to people that need it most in the real economy. This is the framework's most analytically attractive component, and the move that determines whether the broader public reading of the program will support the institutional one. The claim does not rest on conventional rate transmission mechanics. It claims something different and structurally more ambitious. That shrinking the Federal Reserve's financial market footprint redeploys liquidity from asset markets to the real economy. Asset market froth comes down. Real economy credit expands. Small businesses, households dependent on bank lending, communities the post-2008 expansion is widely understood to have missed. These are the beneficiaries the framework names. The instinct of the reader who has watched 15 years of monetary expansion compound in asset markets while wage growth lagged and small business credit standards tightened is to agree. The archive has tested the channel the framework names. The diagnosis it returns is unambiguous. The expansion of Federal Reserve liquidity through the post-crisis era did not reach the small business borrower through the channel policy documents described. The distributional asymmetry is real. It was documented by the institution's own participants across multiple reserve banks and multiple easing cycles. Robert Kaplan at the Dallas Fed surfaced the finding in committee deliberations during the post-pandemic period. Elizabeth Duke on the Board of Governors had made the institutional point earlier, in the period when the post-crisis framework was still being defended on its original promises. From the board staff, demand for most types of loans appeared to remain subdued, and lending standards likely remained tight for many households and firms.
Charles Evans at Chicago, Loretta Mester at Cleveland. Across four decades of easing cycles, the institutional finding was consistent. The pipe the post-crisis framework described
did not carry liquidity to the borrower, the framework's defenders named. The staff economists made the point directly. In September 2011, the FOMC heard from the Mr. Carpenter, "If in fact the real constraint on bank lending now is on the demand side and not so much on the supply side, again, at the margin it should go in the right direction, but it doesn't seem like it could be the answer." The diagnosis the framework invokes survives the archive's testing. The distributional asymmetry is real. Frustration with monetary transmission has been documented inside the institution across decades. Asset markets did receive a disproportionate share of the post-2008 expansion. The small business borrower the policy framework described was not the small business borrower the policy framework reached. The prescription is where the archive refuses. The mechanism the framework invokes operates in the opposite direction from what its prescription requires. Adding liquidity through asset purchases did not transmit to the real economy through the channel the post-crisis framework described. There is no documentary basis in the Federal Reserve's own record for the claim that removing liquidity will transmit in reverse through the same channel. The accommodation withdrawal half of the story may well be correct in its own terms. Reducing the Federal Reserve's footprint in financial markets may bring down asset prices, narrow the froth the framework names, and undo some of the distributional effects the archive has documented. The redeployment half is the claim the archive does not support. The pipe that did not carry liquidity to Main Street in the expansion direction has no record of carrying it in the contraction direction. The diagnosis survives. The prescription does not. The framework's strongest sympathetic claim is the one the archive's documentary record refutes at its prescription point while validating it at its diagnostic point. This is the recognition the framework requires the public to grant in order for the institutional ratification to hold beyond the meeting itself. The recognition is harder to assemble than the institutional ratification, because the public can verify the prescription against outcomes. The institutional ratification can frame around. The framework will hold institutionally for as long as the data does not force the prescription's testing. When the testing arrives, the framework will be evaluated by a public that watched the institution ratify the framework once already in 2021 and saw what followed. The paradox documented an adjacent finding. The institution's recurring tendency to convert valid technical observations into invalid policy prescriptions across 5 decades. The pattern is the same. The direction of the strip is different. The ratification, not the vote. The architecture Warsh has constructed cannot, by the evidence the institution itself produced, close at the scale the commitment promises. The methodology is in the family the archive has scored across 5 decades. The 4-instrument arithmetic stops at the regulatory floor. The 5th instrument's behavioral premise sits against the prior of its own designer. The distributional theory's prescription runs in the direction the institution's own 40-year record says it does not. What remains is not whether the program will be executed, but in what form.
The form is ratification, not approval. The next vote, when it comes, is positioned to be something different from a coalition-building exercise, in which the chair has assembled a majority for a cut on the merits of incoming inflation data. The vote is structured to become the natural output of the framework the chair has been constructing since before he was confirmed. The institutional center, the chairman emeritus remaining on the board, the vice chair, the New York Fed president, the vice chair for supervision, would be presented with an analytical category that has been supplied to them through speeches, testimonies, and operational sequencing the chair did not solicit their approval for. Labor market fragility has been positioned by the seat that controls the supervisory portfolio. Balance sheet regulatory linkage has been positioned by the same seat. Swap line operational fungibility has been positioned by the Treasury Secretary. Political authorization has been positioned by the President. The framework arrives at the meeting as institutional context, not as the chair's proposal.
The institutional center could vote yes on a recalibration framed by this context, where it would vote no on a standalone cut framed against incoming inflation data alone. The vote does not require endorsement of the chair's preferred outcome on the merits of the data. It requires a judgment that the framework is institutionally legible and that voting against it would impose a higher credibility cost than voting with it. The dissenters, Schmidt at Kansas City, Musalem at St. Louis, possibly one or two governors against the framing, are not the chair's problem. Their dissent is the institutional cover the center requires in order to defend its yes vote as independent rather than captured. Without dissent, the center cannot present its vote as a judgment call. With dissent, the center's vote becomes the institutional median position, the default to which the institution returns when the chair has constructed a framework the center finds analytically defensible. This is the structural move the standard reading misses. A procedural majority is still required, and Warsh cannot deliver the cut by fiat. But the chair's primary work is not coalition building on the merits of the cut. It is framework construction, executed through the upstream moves the program has already played. The framework is built to be ratifiable. It is supplied by colleagues whose institutional standing the center respects. It draws on analytical categories: fragile labor market, regulatory floor binding, swap line fungibility, that the center can defend in retrospect, even if the cut itself proves wrong. And it carries the institutional cover of the dissenter's opposition. The framework is positioned to convert the vote on accommodation into a vote on ratification of recalibration. Whether that conversion holds at the next meeting depends on data the framework was built to manage rather than to address. The framework is built to be ratified. The cut is positioned to be delivered. Whether the broader balance sheet program closes at full target depends on Bowman's reform delivering behavioral change successive reform cycles have not produced. Institutional legibility of the framework does not depend on that arithmetic. Its public legibility depends on whether the distributional prescription transmits as advertised, which the archive's documentary record says it does not. The measure documented the institutional capacity to present partial delivery as full through the choice of gauge. The same capacity is available here. The framework is built to deliver the visible outcome. The invisible outcome, the load-bearing arithmetic, the behavioral change, the distributional transmission, the institution will, by its own documented record, deliver in part and announce as complete.
This is the path dependence the distributional argument established. The chair did not choose this configuration. He inherited a personnel strategy completed in 2025. A regulatory seat whose occupant has announced the prescription her own prior analysis predicted would fail. An FOMC committee whose institutional learning from 2021 has not been fully absorbed. And a political environment that authorizes the framework he has built. What remains available is the framework construction. The framework is positioned to produce the ratification. The ratification is positioned to produce the cut. The cut is positioned to be delivered into a data environment the framework was built to manage rather than to address. The board. The archive does not show an institution that lacks the analytical resources to evaluate the program the testimony specifies. It shows an institution that has run, in successive forms, each of the components the program names. The framework construction methodology was applied by Burns to food and energy, by Greenspan to the Boskin discount, by Bernanke and Yellen to special factors, by the institution in 2007 to subprime spillovers, by the institution in 2020 and 2021 under the label transitory. The four-instrument balance sheet program was implemented from 2017 through 2019 until the reserve demand floor revealed itself by breaking the federal funds rate. Discount window and lender of last resort reform has been attempted in successive forms. FDICIA in 1991, primary credit redesign in 2003, the term auction facility from 2007 through 2010,
pandemic-era emergency easing in 2020, the standing repo facility in 2021, and the Bank Term Funding Program in 2023. The distributional channel the program promises to reverse was documented across four decades of easing cycles to run only one direction. Each component is in the archive. Each has been tested. The institution has built its current framework on what remained after the testing was done. The architecture the testimony specifies is collateralized against four bets the institution's own documentary record advises against. The methodology bet, that framework construction by an incoming chair will produce ratifiable categories that the realized data validates rather than refutes. The arithmetic bet, that balance sheet reduction can reach the promised scale without striking the reserve floor. The behavioral bet, that liquidity regulation and discount window reform will change bank treasurer behavior in a way successive reform cycles have not produced. The transmission bet, that shrinking the Federal Reserve's footprint will redeploy financial market liquidity into real economy credit through a channel the institution's own staff named as "Not the Answer" in 2011. Each bet is independently testable. Each, in the documentary record, has been answered in the direction opposite to the one the program requires. The game has started. The opening moves have been played. The chair does not need to win a majority for a standalone rate cut on the merits of incoming inflation data, because he has constructed a framework under which the cut is positioned to be ratified rather than approved on the data alone. A procedural majority is still required. The framework is built to be ratifiable. Whether the institutional center stands behind the framework when the vote arrives is the open question the Post does not predict. The investigation completes the circuit. The chair, under oath at the opening, is the chair who has bound himself to the framework the archive has already scored. The framework has been built before. The institution has documented what it does. The next data point is being produced now. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.